Welcome to episode 239 of the Microsoft Cloud IT Pro Podcast, recorded live on July 16th, 2021. This is a show about Microsoft 365 and Azure from the perspective of IT pros and end users, where we discuss a topic or recent news and how it relates to you. Today, Scott and Ben start off with Scott walking Ben through Azure Resource Explorer. No, not that one, the other one. And then they move into the recently announced Windows 365 service. Today, everything is just not working. Your video isn't working. My PowerShell command to get Azure disks is not working. People showing up to listen to us live is not working. Sounds like it's time for the weekend or vacation.
All sorts of little things. So real quick, let's talk about your disks thing, even though you don't want to. Like, we don't have to solve your problem today.
Okay.
But I think, like, just based on the description of your problem, I would have one recommendation for you to maybe go and try later.
Do you want me to give you a high level of my problem before you tell me the high level solution?
Sure.
Okay. So this is the scenario I'm running up against is I need to get all of the managed disks in a Azure subscription. So I'm connecting to the Azure subscription. I'm doing like a select subscription, throwing in the subscription ID, and then very simply running get-az-disk. No parameters, no resource groups, nothing. Just that, and saving it to a variable.
You're doing this with PowerShell,
yes,
right?
Yes, I'm doing this with PowerShell.
Yep, okay.
And most of the time, like on my local machine, on my Mac, on everything else, it comes back with all the disks, right? So I can go in and look at managed by all the disk properties. For various reasons that we don't need to get into here, I took that script and I'm trying to run it in Azure DevOps on a dedicated Linux host. So exact same commands. I'm testing it on Mac OS. So I'm using PowerShell kernel in my testing. When I run it in DevOps, I get back a collection of containers. I get back, like if I do a disks.count, I get the same amount in DevOps that I do on my machine. So I'm obviously getting the disks, but what ends up coming back is not all of the disk properties, but a whole bunch of like empty, I'd almost call them like empty objects. So if I like cycle through all 13 objects, all that comes back for those is microsoft.azure.commands.compute.automation.models.ps-disk-list. So I have 13 objects that's all that's in there. So I can't go get any of the properties of these disks that I wanted to grab.
How are you running that? Are you running that through like a PowerShell task? Are you doing like a custom script task?
It's a PowerShell task and it's grabbing an actual PowerShell file. And I will say I was able to replicate this once on my local machine where I went out and connected and I just ran $disks equals get VM disk. And then I ran $disks to see what was in there. And I got what I was seeing in DevOps. I ran it like three or four times, continued to get that, stepped away from the computer for like 30 seconds, came back, ran it one more time, and it all started working. So it is almost like it's an asynchronous call and there's some timing issues there. So I've tried putting in some sleeps, but it's so inconsistent. I don't know how long to sleep for or what is really going on there.
It gets a little weird because you're doing it in DevOps. So if you're using like the built-in tasks, then you're locked into potentially like the module versions that are deployed with all of those tasks.
Okay, so I'm running it in dedicated hosts. So we have our own Linux hosts. So I'm going in and installing all of my PowerShell modules and PowerShell and all of that at the very beginning. And then I'm actually running a PowerShell file on that host pool that we created. So I should have control over all of the modules and everything that's running in that whole environment.
I wonder if there's some difference in like task versions or things like that for how they execute or maybe like what versions of a module they look for along the way. Like that could kind of maybe be part of it. And it sounds like you're using the same user identity and everything on both sides. So as far as like authentication to ARM, you're all the same there.
It was literally a copy and paste the script out of the PowerShell file I'm running in DevOps onto my local machine and just like F5 it in code. So, Scott, do you know how many files are shared outside your organization? Or are you sure that every team in your Microsoft 365 tenant has a valid owner? Guess what? ShareGate's got your back. After helping thousands of customers move to Office 365, they've learned that success in the cloud involves more than just migration. That's why they created ShareGate Apricot, an automated governance platform for Microsoft Teams and Microsoft 365 groups. ShareGate Apricot can help you answer questions like these without planning unnecessary restrictions on your users. With ShareGate Apricot, you get full visibility across each team's lifecycle from creation all the way through to archival. You can automate manual tasks involved in identifying problem areas like inactive or orphan teams. And you can collaborate with team owners on corrective measures to keep your teams tidy and secure. That's also why they've combined ShareGate Desktop, their trusted migration and content management tool, with ShareGate Apricot in a single subscription so that you have everything you need to be successful in the Microsoft cloud.
So you had a solution or a recommendation to go look at something.
Well, you had left out the DevOps part earlier. So one of the things that came to mind for me was you've got PowerShell, you've got various versions of various modules, you can have side-by-side things, all sorts of weird things there.
Yep.
Sometimes, like what I like to do when things start to go off the rails a little bit like that is try and figure out, is it something in ARM that's messed up? Or is it something in the PowerShell module itself, like the way that it's processing the JSON that's returned from the ARM REST APIs, in that case for your Git or your list operation, for your disks, things like that. And one of the things I always struggled with for a long time was how to quickly authenticate to ARM just inside like a REST session. So if you want to do something like maybe like Postman or REST client, you know, you might need to go out and do something like, you know, you've got to retrieve a bearer token and include that bearer token in your request, or figure out just in general, like how you're going to authenticate and come across to that thing.
Yep.
But one of the like unsung heroes for a long time, for me at least, was the resources.azure.com site or Azure Resource Explorer. It's like this old janky thing. It was in preview. Like, I think it's still in preview today. It's like G8 or anything like that. I'm not talking about Azure Resource Explorer, like the resource graph stuff that's in the portal.
Okay.
Like, this is a totally different thing. So pull up a web browser. It's like, let's do this in real time. So pull up a web browser and go to resources.azure.com.
Do I have to be in the environment that I want to connect to?
You'll get an option to like choose the environment. I don't think it really matters kind of which one you go into.
Resources.azure.com. Okay.
Yep. So that's going to pull up a site that looks kind of like it was designed 5 years ago and it hasn't been updated since, right? But it kind of familiar to get through. You'll be in read-only mode by default. So from here, you've got a list on the left-hand side in the nav pane. You can browse all your resource providers, all your subscriptions. So like, go ahead and click subscriptions on the left and you'll get a list of all your subscriptions and you'll see the JSON response. And then right up there at the top, because by default you're in the Git mode,
yep,
you'll actually see that you're doing an HTTP Git against management.azure.com /subscriptions, and then the API version of that thing that you're calling.
Got it.
So pretty nifty that you can just kind of browse the API in real time and see the not only the endpoint that was called, like, hey, what was the REST API that was called? Also, what was the block of JSON that was returned to me?
Yep.
And this is all the GUI, so that's kind of okay and ready to go. So what I'm going to do is I'm just going to click on subscriptions. I've got a bunch of subscriptions I have access to, but I'm just going to click on that subscriptions node. And I'm just going to copy that URI there. So management.azure.com/subscriptions, just so I have it on my clipboard. And then I'm going to go up to the URL, the URI, and I'm going to go to resources.azure.com/raw. And I want to make sure that I'm already authenticated to the tenant that I want to be in. So now you should be in like a raw kind of view where you'll have things like a bunch of gits on the left and then no content on the right-hand pane. Like it's just it's a black screen and it looks kind of blank to start with, you know?
Yep, exactly. Okay.
Yep. So what you're going to do is you're just going to type git And then you're going to paste in that URI that you just had. So management.azure.com/subscriptions, you know, ?API-version, blah, blah, blah. But say we wanted to use a different API version or something, we could change all that here. But let's just go with what we copied over. And then you're going to highlight that block of text. So everything with the get, G-E-T, all capital, and then the space, and then the URI that you wanted to call. And then go ahead and hit Control S. Like once that's all highlighted.
Where was I supposed to go after I grabbed that whole get URL?
resources.azure.com/raw.
Oh, the raw, that's right.
So this is where this website and this tool becomes like super magical to me. So you're just going to type get, you're going to paste in that URI, you're going to highlight it and highlight the whole thing and then hit Control S. And what it's going to do is it's going to execute that request in the context of the identity that you're already signed in as. So you can just go ahead and browse the whole API here. Or if you had, say, like something that you wanted to run one off and you know you're doing it manually and you just want to run it one off against the REST APIs, like this is one of my preferred ways to do it because I can just do it all in a web browser. I don't need the Azure CLI. I don't need curl. I don't need REST client. I don't need Postman. I'm not messing with authentication tokens, anything like that. It's all kind of handled for me.
Nice.
Yeah. So in your case, what I was originally going to say is, hey, let's figure out if it's a PowerShell problem or a management.azure.com problem. I would just come into something like this, find out the endpoint for disks list or manage disks list, whatever it is, and go ahead and pump that thing in and see what it returns for you. And you'll see the whole response here. And if you're getting the whole response here, then you know ARM is working. And the next thing that you have to go to is, well, maybe it's PowerShell that's broken and you can investigate, you know, is it actually PowerShell on that dedicated host or whatever it happens to be?
Yes. The other option I might go do is go get the VMs and then go get all the disks attached to the VMs, which works good unless I have to get in an attached disk. We're going to have to play with this some more.
Another way to think about it too might be rather than going against like the endpoints you're going at today, maybe you can get it in like the resource graph in like a tighter query and just have it returned as a maybe tighter, more consolidated response for you. And be able to get at it a little bit easier that way. I think like resource graph is kind of cool and kind of powerful. And I know I often forget that it's sitting there in the background.
Is that, yes, I don't know that I've ever used this before. More stuff to go play with.
The resource explorer or the resource graph?
The resource explorer.
Gotcha. So the resource explorer is super cool. Like I love it, like I said, just for browsing API responses. And, you know, because sometimes even like when you're dealing with a PowerShell commandlet, like you don't want to have to go find the right incantation of the commandlet. You just want to like browse down the hierarchy of your subscription to your resource group, to your resource, and just show me what it looks like in ARM. The other really cool thing you can use this for, like if you find that you struggle with ARM templates or like ARM template documentation, things like that, you're getting the raw JSON response here. So quite often, like a bunch of this JSON can just be reused in something like an ARM template. Or you can carry that knowledge forward to something like a, what's the other thing called? Bicep as well.
Got it. We should talk about Bicep sometime.
We should.
Not today.
Sometime. Not today. Anyway, what do you want to talk about today?
Besides,
now that I took you off the rails.
Now that we went down one tangent. Should we just like completely, well, it's not completely switched. Should we, yeah, it's kind of completely switching. Should we completely switch to the brand new news that came out today? Not today. It's been a long week.
Today, you need a nap.
2 days ago, I need a nap bad. I can't even remember if it was yesterday or the day before. Should we talk about Cloud PC, the brand new innovative technology released by Microsoft?
Well, we should talk about Windows as a service for consumers or small businesses, or all those kinds business. Of things. Yes. Windows 365.
Yes.
Which lives behind a website called Cloud PC.
Right. Which you can get to by going to windows365.microsoft.com. Except that there's nothing there yet, except go log in and it'll tell you you don't have a license for it because it's not coming out until August 2, which is probably like a week after you're hearing this. So this was interesting. I saw the announcement and I don't want to be too... When I look at this, I love the technology and we'll get into some of this. I was a little critical of their marketing because when I saw this announcement, they came across like it's this brand new, innovative, we're going into a whole new world of computing, all of this marketing mumbo jumbo. Like, so it kind of reminded me of Apple sometimes in their conferences, because they're like, we made this new, innovative, beautiful, magical thing. Truth be told, this is just another incantation, another version, another way to have a virtual desktop environment and run Windows in this virtual desktop environment. Kind of like you said, I see this as maybe being a little bit of a consumer approach, a little bit of an SMB. Maybe there's some enterprises that'll use it, but let's be honest, it's just another virtual desktop environment, which VDI has been around for years and years. So there's nothing, in my opinion, there's nothing new or revolutionary about the technology in this whole cloud PC virtual desktop environment. However, there's a lot of really cool things that Microsoft is doing with this version of it when you look at how this ties into their current environment.
For sure. I think separate maybe like marketing from availability of a capability to consumers, or maybe even like prosumers, that has, I think, been not unattainable, but like there's a ton of friction there to get things set up and get it to where it needs to be. And particularly to figure out how to like run some of this stuff on your own, like maybe just for yourself or for a small group of users, in not only a performant manner, but also a cost-effective manner.
Yes.
So take away marketing and things like that. Like, has VDI existed for a long time? Yes. Has desktop as a service existed for a long time? Yes. Is there some like hot new technology that's going to like burn down the world and we're going to grow back and we're going to be better, stronger, faster, all those things? Probably not. But you're talking about maybe like a licensing SKU that, if it's priced the right way and it's palatable, you know, starts to become attractive, maybe even to folks like you and I along the way.
Right. Spot by NetApp is the cloud automation platform that makes it easy to deliver continuously optimized infrastructure at the lowest possible cost. Spot helps their customers get the most out of their cloud investments by automating cloud infrastructure to ensure performance, reduced complexity, and optimized costs. Their machine learning and automation scale to exactly meet application needs using the most efficient mix of instances and pricing models, eliminating the risks of over-provisioning and cloud waste. Best of all, their software works with leading cloud platforms, services, and tools so that you can simplify and automate your cloud infrastructure wherever your workloads and applications run and however you run them. Discover how leading companies, from cloud-native startups to global enterprises, are automating, simplifying, and optimizing their cloud infrastructure with Spot by NetApp. Check them out at spot.io/MSIT, where you can find more information, request a demo, or even start a free trial.
That's what I love about this. So, kind of like you said, putting all the marketing aside, if you haven't seen this, what Windows 365 is think Office 365, Microsoft 365, where it ties into that existing Microsoft 365 environment. You essentially go buy a license, and that it has been confirmed. Not all the pricing is out there. There is some pricing that has leaked. And based on that, I think it's going to be, I'm not going to say it's cheap, but I would say it's palatable. It is competitive, something I'd be willing to pay, where I'm not like, really, you're going to charge me that much for that. But that price is a fixed per user per month cost, just like Microsoft 365. And at least from what I've seen initially, all you really need to do is go buy the license, go into your Microsoft 365 admin center, assign the appropriate license to the user, maybe do some things around some sizing of what size machine you want, because you do get the option for multiple machine sizes, different CPUs, memories, disk sizes, all of that. And once it's assigned to them, they can literally just go log in and start using Windows 10 in the cloud. So it goes back to that barrier to entry, where a lot of the stuff with Windows 365, I would say you could do it with Azure Virtual Desktop, with Citrix, with something else. But to your point, there was a lot of configuration in settings that had to go into it. Now, Microsoft does all that for you in terms of joining it to your tenant and doing some things with endpoint protection. There's a lot of different stuff that goes in, and it's like a click, 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 and
you're up and running.
Yes. So just to kind of like baseline and give a sense for where this is at for maybe like SMB, you're a small tenant, or you've got an organization with like 5 to 10 users versus you're an organization with even like 500. And maybe you're looking at things like Azure Virtual Desktop or Citrix or things like that along the way. So at Inspire, which was, I don't even know if last week.
I think it was this week.
Inspire was this week. Like there's been a lot of stuff going on. During one of the Inspire sessions, one of the demonstrations was how to provision licensing for a Windows 365 business license. And the particular SKU that came up and was provisioned was a 2V CPU, 4 gigs of RAM, and 128 gigs of storage. So it's specifically Windows 365 business. So it's going to be for orgs and less than 300 overall users. But that pricing was $31 US per user per month. And that can be kind of like, I look at that and I go, you know what? Like it's only 4 gigs of RAM. So you're not going to be running like Teams on that successfully or anything, but not that you'd want to run Teams with remote video and voice and everything through it anyway, maybe necessarily.
Right.
But if I just have a light kind of worker, they need access to a web browser, they need access to Word and Excel, and they need it in a managed environment or a quasi-managed environment in this case with some level of confidence that they're protected from viruses and things like that. Like $31 per user per month doesn't sound too bad. Like I even think of myself as maybe like, a power user, but there are times when I'm on my Mac and I don't want to spin up an entire virtual machine, or I don't want to, go ahead and, have to figure out how I'm going to run this like Windows workload along the way. There's also things like I'm on my iPad and I've got a mouse and I've got a keyboard, but I might want to actually like run Windows that has my programs on it too. Like it's not like this is some thinly provisioned service in the cloud. It always comes up as like a blank thing. It's your user, your machine, things like that along the way. So it becomes super compelling from that angle. Like there's tons of architecture around it, all the other things, but just from an end of the day, like per user, per month, dead simple way to deploy these kinds of things, I think that's a compelling place to be. So the way I've been framing it in the back of my head is when I think about, where they're coming at from a marketing angle and you're hearing about Azure Virtual Desktop and, all these other things. Like if you look at the two offerings holistically, one is about being dead simple. Like you said, let's just assign a per user, per month license. I'm going to figure out how big that user's machine has to be. And boom, here you go. They go to a website, they click a button and they're in an RDP session. They're off and running. So that's like simplicity 101, right? We're doing the KISS thing. Then there's, I'm an organization and I might be, that 300 person organization where this would work for me, but I have way different needs. I need multiple flavors of desktops. I've got a ton of custom software I need to deploy on top of those. I need them to be attached to my network. So I need like VNets and peering and ExpressRoute and things like that. Complexity, but ultimately like I need some measure of flexibility along the way. And that's where you're going to find that like true VDI fits in. You're going to pay more for it, but complexity and flexibility are going to be there for you. So it's like simplicity versus flexibility. And I think that's a good way to kind of measure it in the back of your head. If you're sitting down and you're looking at this and you're going like, wow, it sounds like a lot of friction to onboard to Azure Virtual Desktop or Citrix or like whatever your VDI solution of choice is. And all of a sudden, here's this other thing. Like you can look at the requirements and go like, huh, maybe that's simple enough for me to get to where I need to be.
I would agree. Because from my perspective, kind of looking at the pricing again, $31 a month, it's not big enough for me. I'm going to have to see what probably the 4 CPU, 16 gigs is for what I do. But this is something I'll probably go out and add to my subscription. Right now, I do have Azure Virtual Desktop stood up. I have a VM. But every time I need to use it, because I'm trying to save costs for me, I have to go in, start it up, it auto shuts down. I have credits in Azure, so I'm not paying for it in Azure, but I don't know that even from that cost perspective for a small business, somebody like me, that I would actually save any money by doing it in Azure. and I'm getting a lot of the benefits. And even you had mentioned before, $30 a month per user. You kind of extrapolate that out. You're looking at 360-ish a year. Over 3 years, you're at $1,000. How often do corporations refresh PCs every 3 to 5 years for about that same price? Maybe they have a little bit higher performance level, but I don't think that cost is that bad. And again, I like from that simplicity standpoint too, this does a lot of things that Azure Virtual Desktop doesn't in terms of, and I saw this in the demo, we'll post a link to, there's a Microsoft Mechanics did some stuff on it. There's a bunch of articles out here about it, but it does things like when you spin these up, they're automatically joined to Endpoint Manager that has all the Microsoft Endpoint Configuration Manager support. You can actually do your own custom images as well, I think, from what I saw. So you're not even just locked into the images from Microsoft. It's on its own virtual network. So there is a lot of the Azure stuff going in the background, but I think you can even go set this up and join it to your existing Azure Virtual Network, your existing VNets.
There's a really good breakdown on Nerdio that has this kind of broken out between what are kind of the core differences at each layer, whether it's things like cores, RAM, disk, network connectivity. The other kind of fulcrum point for you might be how you want those machines to be authenticated, like do they need to be domain joined versus just Azure AD joined?
Yep.
And what that looks like for you along the way. But I think it's all like for all the different things that come out and kind of all the confusion and titling and naming and things like that, this one's actually a little bit clearer to me.
Yeah, I would agree. You brought up the AD. That was one thing that jumped out to me too as a difference here was, as far as I know, I don't believe you can do Azure Virtual Desktop yet without a domain controller. No, it could be a domain controller on a server you spin up in Azure, could be on-premises, but you still need a domain controller for Azure Virtual Desktop. For Windows 365, you only need Azure AD. So if you are in that cloud-only environment, you don't want to have to mess with a domain controller just to get that VDI interface. That's the other area where I think this becomes a really compelling alternative to Azure Virtual Desktop.
So I think that's one of those things, like, you know, we're back to potentially
the simplicity.
We're back to kind of requirements and what you need along the way there. Do you need to join an Active Directory? Because that's going to be a requirement with AVD, like you said, is to go ahead and have either access to an on-premises domain or a domain that's up in Azure that is actually an Active Directory, Directory Services domain, whether that's a ADDS or ADDS extended out from an Azure Active Directory versus the kind of non-enterprise side, the Windows 365 side, all you need is an Azure AD tenant to get started. And there is no option there to go ahead and domain join as far as I know.
Yes, I would agree with that.
There's other limitations too. So AVD might be preferable for you, like in your model where you're spinning machines up, you're spinning them down, you're trying to optimize for cost as best you can. You probably have like roaming profiles. So you're using like FS Logics, things like that. In Windows 365 or that cloud PC, there's no support for FS Logics. So, you know, you're getting a disk that's provisioned with you. And if that disk goes away, gets deleted, whatever it is, your desktop isn't roaming with you to the next kind of thing either. So you've got to think about maybe things like that as well. But if you're in an organization where like you do known folder stuff with OneDrive, everybody's documents, downloads, all the things are already in the cloud anyway, like, you know, what is the actual burden, you know, if you had to provision a new PC for somebody? Is it the end of the world?
Yeah. Do you feel overwhelmed by trying to manage your Office 365 environment? Are you facing unexpected issues that disrupt your company's productivity? IntelliJink is here to help. Much like you take your car to the mechanic that has specialized knowledge on how to best keep your car running, IntelliJink helps you with your Microsoft Cloud environment because that's their expertise. IntelliJink keeps up with the latest updates in the Microsoft Cloud to help keep your business running smoothly and ahead of the curve. Whether you are a small organization with just a few users up to an organization of several thousand employees, they want to partner with you to implement and administer your Microsoft Cloud technology. Visit them at intellijink.com/podcast. That's intelligink.com/podcast for more information or to schedule a 30-minute call to get started with them today. Remember, IntelliJink focuses on the Microsoft Cloud so you can focus on your business.
The other thing you do get with AVD 2 is that AVD also gives you that option to publish just an application. So if you don't want to give your users like the full desktop experience, you just want to say you need to be able to run PowerShell on a Mac, like the native PowerShell, not the PowerShell core, or publish out certain applications through AVD without giving them access to the full Windows 10 desktop. That's another one of those advantages of AVD. Again, it's going to be a little bit more complex. It probably caters more towards enterprises where they're publishing out just applications rather than the whole desktop experience. Like this, the Windows 365 is just going to be the full desktop. You can't just kind of publish out apps from that virtual environment.
Yeah.
And it looks like it's going to support all the different platforms. Like you said, iPad, iOS, Windows.
It's kind of like everything AVD supports today, because it's almost like it's AVD on the back end, but it's managed by somebody else.
I think in one of the articles they actually do just come out and say, you know what, we're using AVD, or they're at least using all the technologies that they have created as a part of AVD for this service. So yeah, that would be my assumption. So I'm looking forward to trying it, because right now when I do want to use Windows, in that same boat as you, I either have to go boot up a VM, I have to go log into my Azure portal and start a VM and wait for it to come on. Just having this always available, especially to be able to access from an iPad or just quickly pull up on my desktop. Once you get past all the marketing, again, I think this is a really compelling service, and I personally am excited to give it a try.
I think it's got some interesting, nice things there. It's weird timing for me too. So like I said, I do virtualization on my Mac for like some of the workloads that I need to run Windows stuff for, and I do Parallels to do that. So I do Parallels Pro. That's $100 a year right there. And then, you know, I did, like, I went out and bought just a crappy, like, $600 laptop to, you know, it's a honking beast just to have on the side where I could run Windows workloads. But if I take that, like, that $600, if I potentially did something like this and I could wrap my head around, like, was I really going to keep that $600 laptop for 2 years? You know, like what's all that going to look like? But realistically, like, if I find the right size machine, like, if that next one up, like, if I could get a machine with 8 gigs of RAM and 256 gigs of storage. Like, I don't want it for day-to-day stuff. I just want it to like rip into Excel, do some, you know, light processing, things like that. Like, if I can get something like that for, I don't know, $40, $50 a month, and then maybe even like come off a monthly subscription sometimes and come back on when I need it, like that starts to be in like semi-compelling territory. Like, I can, like, as an end user, I can almost rationalize my way into that one.
Yeah. I won't lie. I expected the price to be, well, we'll still have to see what the higher end PCs are. That price came in lower than I would have guessed.
Like you said, there isn't pricing for other stuff out there. That should be available by August 2nd, I believe.
Yep.
Sometime in August, pricing will be out. Because you do have a lot of kind of configuration options when it comes to sizing. The smallest machine is, so that one that we talked about, that 2 vCPU, 4 gigs, 128 being $31. There's two machines that are still smaller than that. So the assumption is those would be even cheaper. So there's as small as 1 vCPU, 2 gigs of RAM, and 64 gigs of hard drive space. And they go all the way up to 8 vCPU, 32 gigs of RAM, and 512 gigs of drive.
It's like you're buying a
PC from the store.
A little bit. It's almost like you're buying one from the Azure portal. Pick your size and series and go with it along the way.
I did not realize Windows 10 or what I'm going to presume will eventually be Windows 11 would actually run on a single CPU and 2 gigs of RAM.
I don't think any sane person would recommend it, but like, or at least like what you and I would put up with for performance maybe isn't what somebody else is willing to put up with. You know, it's certainly going to depend on what you're running on top of that thing.
It's interesting. I'm excited. I'm glad I don't have to wait too long for it too, because I really do want to give it a try.
Like you said, there's a bunch of articles and things going on about this. I'd recommend everybody go out to the Windows 365 tech community. I think it's Mechanics video. It might be on like YouTube or things like that, but it's embedded in the article that I'll link in the show notes. It's 14 minutes long, give or take. It's, you know, pretty consumable. It does have the architecture angle going to it, but you know what? Like, get over it, look past it, do what you need to do to get there. And you should be in a like mostly good place. Like it's a decent on-ramp to figure out what's happening along the way.
And I watched it with jaded eyes because I'd done so much with AVD already, especially if you haven't done anything with a virtual desktop environment before. I would say, yeah, there's some architecture in there, but it's definitely worth it to kind of see how all of it works and onboards and all of that.
So I would recommend taking a look at that video. And then there's a really good comparison, like a step-by-step, how does this look technically from maybe like a back-end architecture perspective? Like, what do I gain access to with AVD? What am I losing access to with Cloud PC, Windows 365? On Nerdio, I'd recommend everybody go read that one as well. So I will include those in the show notes. Show notes, as always, can be found at mscloudITpropodcast.com. And this will be at /episode239.
Yes, we're getting close to 250, Scott.
Someday.
Hey, look, someone just showed up to listen to us in Discord.
Well, now that I know that you're not paying attention to me anymore, maybe we'll want to stop because I probably have a meeting I need to get to.
I have work I need to do so I can actually sleep. But yes, if you do want to join us in Discord, listen live, join the conversation. We started having a few more side conversations too in Discord throughout the week. Go sign up for the newsletter, get a Discord link, click on it, sign up, come join us over there.
Yeah. Well, thanks as always for the time, Ben.
All right. Thanks, Scott. Enjoy your meetings, enjoy your weekend, and we'll talk to you next week.
All right. Have a good one.
If you enjoyed the podcast, go leave us a 5-star rating in iTunes. It helps to get the word out so more IT pros can learn about Office 365 and Azure. If you have any questions you want us to address on the show or feedback about the show, feel free to reach out via our website, Twitter, or Facebook. Thanks again for listening and have a great day.